Welcome to Model Minority Moms, where we talk about the meaning of success in career, family, and life. We are Jeanette Park,
Kate Wong,
and Susan Liu,
Harvard classmates and Asian American working moms who get real about the pressures of fitting in while standing out.
Greetings, greetings. Welcome to another episode of Model Minority Moms. We are going to talk about the number one thing that I'm always afraid of, which is getting in trouble. And we are going to be talking about discipline. No, I'm serious.
This is not about you. This episode is not about you getting in trouble, Susan. I love how your mind just went there.
I know, but see, that's it. That is it, right? Like, how were you disciplined as a kid? And how does that influence how you discipline your kids? And for me, as an adult, anytime anyone's like calling me and it's not a planned call, I go, oh shit, I'm in trouble. Or I get an email from somebody and I just assume I'm in trouble. It just stems from early childhood. So super excited to talk about getting in trouble with all of you for today's episode. So let's just kick it off like we always do, which is how our past influences our present. How were you disciplined growing up? Spanking.
Oh, man.
Nobody wants to talk. No spanking. Yelling. Locked in a room. Like silent treatment. Tell me.
You know, I feel like we should sometimes put disclaimers when we have episodes like this because...
Like a trigger disclaimer?
Yes.
Oh, we should.
We should. Okay, so disclaimer, trigger warning. There may be some unpleasant information disclosed here.
Do you want to go first, Kate?
I mean... Yeah. Okay, fine. Since I said that, I guess I'll just go first. As everybody knows, I have a little poor orphan Annie story because I didn't really spend time with my parents before we came to the U.S. when I was 5 and a half. So I can't really speak to discipline before then because I don't think my parents disciplined me because they weren't really around.
But do you remember being disciplined by your caretakers?
At my boarding preschool, which is very traumatic. In fact, the few memories I have are of being disciplined. Basically, like, you know, back then in the 80s, Chinese caregivers, they just pinch you or whatever. If you're not listening, you know, it's definitely very traditional top down.
Like, where would they pinch you?
On your arm. It's not like they don't bruise you, but it's just like, hey, I'm not saying it's right, but, you know, I don't remember.
Okay, so pinching.
Maybe I was spanked. I don't know. But the most memorable is verbal abuse, right? Where we all slept in one big room in the middle of the night, kind of like an orphanage with beds next to each other. And they don't want you to wet the bed. I think I've told this anecdote before. So they'd roust us at like midnight, all of us kids, and force us to go pee in one of the, back then it was like the squatty toilet.
So for those who might not know, it's a hole in the ground.
Yes.
And there's kind of like a porcelain or it might be plastic kind of.
Squoval. It's a squoval shaped porcelain.
Well,
yes. Bowl in the
ground. But it's like in the ground, right? It's flush with the ground. And so yes. You essentially squat over this thing. Sorry, I just want to paint more of a picture of what that actually looks like.
Yeah. And so the sides where your feet go, there's maybe the porcelain area has some ridges on it
so that you don't slip. Yes.
And you're maybe wearing slippers or something on top of it.
Probably. Yes.
And then you squat.
You squat.
And then you pee or poop.
Yes.
And then maybe there's like a bucket of water that you splash down into the thing.
I think we had a flushing mechanism in ours.
Great. Yeah. Okay. And so there's an adult there. It's midnight. You're 3 or 4 years
old.
Yeah.
So they threaten you. If you don't always want to pee. But if you don't, they're like, you don't pee, we're going to flush you down the toilet. You know, so basically, you can imagine at preschool, that was like the kind of discipline that I got.
And just then, like threatening.
Yeah. Threat. It's pretty typical. You know, if you don't do anything, we're going to threaten you. Don't do anything, we're going to threaten you. I did not ever obviously get flushed down the toilet. But and then when we came to the U.S., you know, my parents, I think it's very common with that generation, right? My parents definitely use corporal punishment with me. Spanking, pinching, and ample threats. All that kind of thing,
how would they threaten you?
Oh, well, they didn't have to threaten me that much because I was pretty like obedient. But, you know, oh, well, you can't do this if you don't get your homework done, then you can't this. So I always knew that in order to get somewhere, I had to do something. And also, like Susan, I actually really identify with your reaction. Like if to this day, sometimes if I get an email or somebody's like, hey, can we talk? I get this sinking feeling in the bottom of my belly like I fucked up. And I'm going to get punished for it. It's still there. I'm almost 40. And that's so sad. No, you're laughing, Susan, but you know exactly how I feel.
I'm
right?
laughing because I feel the same way.
Yeah. And so, you know, like that kind of just fill in the blank, you know. And I think especially with my dad, I had a very up and down relationship with him. He would check my homework until I was in high school. And if I made mistakes, which obviously you make mistakes, we can talk about that, right? You're not allowed to make mistakes, even though you're like 8, 9, or 10. You get yelled at if you made a mistake, you know, on your math homework. And so it's sort of like mistakes are not allowed. You have to get it right the first time, which now as an adult, we can talk about this later, but it's just so ridiculous, right? So it was very fear-driven, very threat-oriented, very fear of making a mistake, must be perfect kind of upbringing for me.
Did you ever like get grounded or anything?
Not really.
No grounding.
I think my parents didn't understand what grounding was.
But maybe you didn't need to be grounded because you're always at home reading Chinese classics.
Correct.
Like you didn't leave the house.
But I think that was because of fear. I was afraid even for a long time to invite friends over to my house because my priority was studying. I didn't start inviting friends really over to my house until I was like in late high school, you know, and like all the stuff where my parents like, you can't paint your nails until you're 13. You can't wear a bikini two-piece until you're 16. You can't date until you're 18. I never even protested. My spirit was so beaten down. By that point, it's sort of like, why even question what the parents said? Well, yeah, sure. Okay, those are the rules, you know?
Whoa.
I know. That's why, and we can talk about this later, when I went to college, I had a major rebellion phase, but that was like massively delayed because I didn't get to act it out when I was living at home with my parents. We had a very bad relationship the first year of college. How about your own upbringings? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would say mostly, I think I was a very compliant child, but I think that was half because I knew what would happen if I stepped out of line. And the other half, because there's this dynamic with my parents where I was kind of from a very young age became a pseudo parent or like a pseudo adult in my household. You know, I couldn't act out because my family was kind of chaotic to begin with, even without me acting out. So I felt like there was no really room for me to act out. And my parents, when they didn't like what my brother or I did, it was different between my parents. I feel like my dad, he just didn't deal with the disciplining a lot. He was kind of more loose and fun parent. But then if it kind of reached a certain point, he would just blow up and it would get very scary quickly. If that makes sense. The only time somebody hit me that left marks on my body were like from my dad. And so he would just totally lose control. And that was very scary. There was always kind of the threat of that happening. That was always kind of in the background for my family overall and me as well. And then I think with my mom, she had less crazy like this is nuclear war blowups. But just on the day to day, there was a lot more like slapping, hitting with a wire hanger. That kind of stuff, like yelling. They had no framework really for disciplining. It was very reactive to whatever was happening in the moment. It was very emotional and it was out of control sometimes, like a lot of times. Yeah, I think that was disciplining for me. It wasn't like really about schoolwork because my parents, it's a little funny and weird given my academic history, but my parents had really not that much expectations for me and my brother around academics. They never checked our homework. My brother, I would say, I hope he can't complain. He can't complain about me saying this because this is true. He pretty much half paid attention through most of his school career. And my parents never gave him a hard time about it and never gave me a hard time about it. I was totally self-monitoring. So their disciplining was not about school. I think it's partly because they themselves were not necessarily like that high achieving in school. I think they were smart people, but for other reasons, it was not like a priority for them. And so it was more about making too much noise or like arguing between my brother and I or leaving a mess or doing like other types of behaviors that they didn't like. That was kind of how we were disciplined. And I don't even know, the word discipline almost doesn't feel like the right word to me because like discipline to me kind of connotes you're trying to get to a different set of behaviors. And what I experienced a lot with my parents was they actually didn't even really have a clear idea of what else they wanted us to do. It was just more like, I feel triggered or I feel annoyed. I don't like what's happening right now. So I'm going to act out or respond or react. So that was kind of the situation in my family, growing a family of origin.
Maybe the phrase is like, how did your family of origin maintain an illusion of control?
Yeah. Well, can I ask, Jeanette, since you have a brother, just very quickly, was he disciplined differently? Was he punished corporally?
Yeah, that's a good question. At least my memory of different things that happened in childhood are a little bit blurry. And so I wouldn't say they're entirely reliable, but my recollection of it was that I got hit like far more often than my brother. I think both because I was the oldest child, and I think when my mom wanted to hit my brother, he would just run away. And for whatever reason, I would just sit there and
take it.
Yeah, take it. Get the punishment. I think it might also touch on some other themes where, to a certain degree, I was a little bit like the blame child in our family. And I think that partly has to do with being older, too. Like, if my brother and I were arguing and my parents were getting annoyed or triggered, it was like my fault. And so I do think that I got hit significantly more than my brother did.
Did your brother say, hey, thanks, sis, for doing that?
Oh, no, sorry. It's just a knee-jerk reaction. No. No, I think that we all didn't have really like the presence of mind. I was actually talking about this with my therapist. Listeners of past episodes might remember that I went to predominantly Korean American elementary school from kindergarten to third grade. And then even after I transferred to a different school from fourth grade and then middle school, it was like minority majority school. So there were no like majority racial group. But the plurality, so the biggest minority group, were Koreans, Korean American kids. And I just remember this was pretty much a common experience among my Korean American peers. One sad story is I remember going on the school bus to go to middle school, and there was this one guy, ironically, he was a pastor's kid, and he would sing this song. He was very troubled in school, always getting into trouble, always like getting disciplined at school. And he would sing this song, recycle, reduce, reuse, child abuse. That was like a song that he made up. You know what I mean? Kids just make up these weird songs and, you know, say weird things. But we kind of all knew, I think, what he was talking about and what his home situation was like. And I think a lot of us, maybe in some families, it was more mild, and in some families, it was worse. But we all kind of understood that this was not something that was surprising to us. Do you know what I mean? Right. So it was like in that way, I think for most of elementary and middle school, it was just like in the water. When you're a kid, you don't have a lot of context. And so you just kind of accept it and learn how to survive it, because that is really all you know. And it seems like the kids you know are also kind of going through the same thing. I mean, this is also sad talking about it now, but that is like how it was.
Did you ever hear your parents were like, if you report me or if you tell your teachers and then call CPS, then actually they're going to just take me away and then you're going to be like a foster kid. So do you want that, or do you want to be homeless? And then you're like, oh man, is that a worse situation? Sounds like it. I guess I can't say anything. Like,
oh yeah.
It was just so normal.
Yeah. This was like a common thing among Korean parents. They would openly discuss it at Korean parties or social gatherings about how in America, if you called the police or whatever, then they will take your children away from you, even if you just spank them or whatever. It's something that I definitely knew. And when my parents had conflict, and sometimes their conflict would be violent against each other, I couldn't call the police or anyone, because my mom and my parents had told me, basically, if you call the police, then you guys might be taken away from us. And like, as a kid, you're kind of terrified of your parents. But then this is where it gets very screwed up with the whole attachment thing. When the attachment gets all messed up, is even though you're scared of your parents, you still feel more scared of not being with them.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so you don't call the police. And then what the fuck do you do? Right. It's like, so, yeah, sorry, it's so heavy. But yeah, that was kind of my experience. And it's like, yeah. Anyway, I'll just pause there.
Well, thanks for sharing that, Jeanette. I'm sorry that happened to little Jeanette.
Yeah, I'm sorry too. I mean, I'm still kind of like working through it.
Yeah, we're all working through it.
We're all working. Yeah.
Well, what I really love about talking with all of you is that, just, you know, Kate's his only child. Jeanette, you're the older of two, and I'm the youngest of four. And so positionally, the way we talk about a thing that I think as simple as discipline or punishment, We have such distinct but yet archetypal experiences. So I was the youngest of four, and I don't think my parents ever hit me because they delegated that to my two older brothers. And so my mom would be like, oh, you're not going to listen? You're not going to listen? When she bites her upper lip, I know I'm like fucked because she makes me go upstairs and she made me kneel down on my knees and she would say, wait, in her master closet where all her clothes were. And I kneel and I wait and I start crying. And then she'd send one of my brothers in who are like 7 years older and 9 years older than me. And then they'd have a variety of tools. So, you know, the feather duster, that's a wooden stick, right? So feather duster, chopstick, or belt.
Chopstick?
How do you, they just fucking hurt. Like hitting at your fingers or just.
Oh, okay.
I mean, more your fingers and a belt. Okay. And then it was more about like the building up and the anticipation of yelling at me and telling me how I did wrong and how I didn't listen. This is like, I didn't fold my clothes and I didn't put it in the cabinet. And maybe they told me to do it 3 times, but maybe I'm 7, but maybe I didn't do it. Right. I don't know, like wanting a toy, crying for it or something. And they'd be like, no. And so in my house, I was not allowed to cry. And then when I start crying, they say, don't cry. And it would make me cry even more. And then I'd be like, hit. So I would say overall, I think maybe it was like more 70% of the time, it was the threatening and like the preparing to hit me. And then the 30% of the time, it was actual hitting and spanking.
Question. Why do you think your parents outsourced the spanking to your brothers? Like,
I think they're busy. Maybe my parents actually didn't have the heart to do it, but I think they're busy.
It but don't like, you think it's fucked up that they had your brothers? I hope this is not going to create some like trauma issues for you to think about this. But do you remember like when your brothers first started doing this? Like how old were they?
I was like 6 and 7 and 8.
So your brothers were 7 and 9 years older. So they were 15 and 13.
But to me, they seemed so big, you know, they're so
like,
grown up.
Did they seem afraid? Like they felt forced or they were into it?
They complied because you didn't want to mess with my mom, man.
So they were afraid of your mom. So they obeyed.
Oh, yeah. Me.
But could you tell if they were like, do you know what I mean? Because I feel like a hit kid, like hitting that. Yeah, wouldn't you have some kind of like, even if you had to do it? Like, wouldn't you just feel like, I'm really sorry? Like, did any of them ever say, I'm really sorry, sis? Like,
no,
no.
Yeah, you know, this is great. We've never even talked about it as adults. Because like now we're all chill. We're like peers. But now that I think about it, I'm like, yeah, there will always be this power dynamic held over me that they can't ever understand because they were the one in power. But even other things like I really liked watching the TV show Blossom.
Yes, you've mentioned this before.
Oh, my God. This was a story I had to cut from my memoir. I loved it.
Oh,
I know.
Okay.
But like I would still watch it. But they didn't like that Blossom had a girlfriend named 6 or 7 or something. And yeah, her best friend. But then she would talk about sex or talk about something around relationships to the point where it was flagged to my either brothers or my mom somehow that I shouldn't be watching it. And so whenever they found me watching it, I would get beat. But the thing is, when my mom and dad would go out of town or be gone for like an evening, my brothers would force me to watch Freddy Krueger, Nightmare on Elm Street, Exorcist. They forced me to watch all these movies. I don't understand why I was getting beat by watching Blossom. Mm-hmm. Anyways, so there was this culture around I'm not allowed to cry. And there was just a lot of verbal abuse saying like I'm stupid. I'm too emotional. A lot of I'm stupid, which is so funny because then out of all of us, I went to Harvard. And then also like my work for a living is around talking about trauma healing and being vulnerable while doing it. So it was like the very things I've been shamed about for so long is my craft and my strength now. It's really ironic because it was certainly suppressed for a long time, or I felt a lot of shame around it because I wasn't allowed to.
Yeah, I've been thinking about this because I feel like when you are told those things like, oh, you're dumb or you're too emotional or whatever it is, then there's kind of like 2 ways to respond, right? Either you could believe it, oh, I am dumb and like I will never, you know, do. And I feel like a lot of women around me, especially Asian American women, our response has been, fuck that, you know? And there's this kind of anger around like, I'm just going to do whatever it takes to overcome that. But then in that way, it's like also some of the motivation gets like a little twisted up. Do you know what I mean? We can't do it just because we like it. There's this kind of like fucked up upness about it. You know
it's
what I mean?
It's still attached like, to a perpetrator, like our own purpose around it or motivation.
Yeah, exactly. It can't just be because we like it, because that's who we are. It feels very attached to this. Fuck you, you know, like,
I'm going to get the large popcorn at the movie theater, even though really I just want a small, but I'm going to get the large one because I've always been denied it. And then I'm going to eat it, even though I'm don't want to waste it. You know, like it's just so fraught. Simple things are so fraught. So anyways, I got yelled at a lot too because I wanted things. I wanted to be in band. I want to play the trombone, sit next to Sean Dwyer. Love him. He never gave me a chance in fourth grade. I wanted to play volleyball, which was the last argument my mom and I ever had. And then I continued to do things after my mom passed when I was in sixth grade. I wanted to do a lot of things. My dad said no, and I still did it anyways. He was very frustrated with me as a single parent. I wanted to do wrestling. I wanted to do student government. I was on the California Youth Council for the state of California representing my county, and I'd be flying to LA every month. And he'd be like, where are you going? This is in high school. I did public service in Nicaragua and Costa Rica, and I fundraised to go there. And I asked him for some money, and I applied for a scholarship. But like all these things, like going out doing community service, it was like hell to him. And he would just continue to yell at me and say, I don't listen. I'm delinquent. And then also, I feel like this is just like confessional here. Whenever I had a boyfriend, because I wasn't allowed to have a boyfriend until I got a master's degree, but I still had boyfriends. And he always knew. He always knew when I had a boyfriend. And then he'd go on this rampage and say, do you want to be homeless? I'm going to kick you out of the house. You need to break up with your boyfriend. His whole concern was like, what does he have to compare to rural Vietnam, where there's no birth control? Education's your only way out, even though I was essentially the valedictorian most of my schooling. But it didn't matter to him. And I don't know what he thought community service was.
Shame, Susan, shame. You should have deuced California, whatever you...
Yeah, he really thought I was this weird devil. And it was so crazy, you know, and I tried to help out the nail salon when I could, but then I also wanted to do these other things. So I've always been disobedient. So whereas Kate, you never even actually thought about being disobedient.
I know. I was just thinking it just was beaten out of me. I gave up so easily.
Yeah. See, it was beaten in me. And then I just kept going. I just felt like life was so boring if I didn't do these things. And my own internal calling to do it just superseded my parent being mad at me, as you will read in the memoir. We had a pretty bad relationship in high school and college, and I'm still often in repair with my father. I think it's in the early childhood, it was physical punishment and a lot of threatening. And then high school, college, grad school, a lot of like just verbal put downs. Okay, I wrote this in the book, so I'm okay saying it, is at my high school graduation party. Everyone came over and we had like a cake and a barbecue and it was really fun. And people gave me all these presents. My mentors came, my teachers came, my friends came, and then everyone left. And then my dad said, no one actually likes you.
Oh, man.
They're faking and lying to your face. I remember I ran out of the house that day and I felt pretty mad and I felt pretty excited that I was going to move across the country and go to Harvard.
Well, you know, that's like his stuff, right? I mean, that's his stuff. That's his baggage, and I could say a lot of things. That's his stuff that he's putting on you. But yeah, as a kid, you don't really know that. You just feel like, oh, my parent hates me.
Yeah, or maybe my parent's right, and I've got the wool pulled over my eyes, and I'm so naive to think that these people like me. Even when you're 18, I'm saying like when you're a kid, age 4, 2, 13, 12, of course, everything that they say is going to have a big impact on you. And so I thought like, oh, when you're older, when you're a teenager, you'll know better. And it's still like these lines really impacted me. And even though I can rationally, objectively understand and hold my father with compassion and understand maybe where those comments came from, it really messed me up, man, in terms of being paranoid about people's motivations.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to make a Dr. Becky reference
here. Tell me about her.
So she recently gave a TED Talk, and this goes back to the idea of attachment and how really it's like the need of a child to be attached to their parents that makes a lot of this have such a fucked up impact. Because when your parents are not right to you, it's like you have to somehow still find a way to be attached to them. She says something like, you know, for kids in their world, their parent is God. So it's like they would rather live in a world where they are bad and God is right than in a world where God is bad and you are right. As a kid, you need to believe that your parents are good. And so I feel like I struggle with this too, right? I feel like even as I'm approaching 40, it's like on one hand, one part of my brain understands that some of these things that my parents did and said had nothing to do with me and are not true. But there's a part of me that does believe. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that part of me that does believe them is so deeply ingrained in my psyche, it's hard to get it out. And so I feel like there is this anxiety a little bit of believing my own perceptions of a situation. Because I think as a kid, a lot of times I would be looking at a situation like, oh, my dad is hitting me. It's like, it's, I don't want to, yeah, I think it's too sad for me and other people who may be listening to like hear more about the situation. But my dad is hitting me like pretty violently, you know, in this situation over basically nothing. So it's one part of my objective assessment of the situation is like my dad's losing it and this is his fault. But then another assessment of the situation is actually my dad is right and this is my fault. I deserve to be hit like this. Especially when I'm under stress, I feel like there is this kind of dual track in my mind of rational Jeanette, but then there's also more deeper Jeanette that just cannot trust objective Jeanette. Does that make sense? Mm. And it causes a lot of anxiety for me. So anyway, I'm sorry that your dad said that to you. You know, as an adult, I think we could all look at that and say, that is a very fucked up thing to say to your daughter. And two, it's not about you. It's really all his shit that he obviously has no place to put it. So he's just putting it on you. But still, at the same time, you could know all of these things as his child. But I'm just saying that it could still cut really deep, even though you know it's not about you. And that parent-child relationship is so different from any other type of relationship, right? Imagine like if a stranger came off the street and said something fucked up like that, you'd just be like, I don't know what's going on with you. And you'd be able to brush that off. But to have your parents say that is a totally different thing. Anyways.
Yeah.
Just going off.
Yeah. And it's hard to read things like everyone's doing the best that they can. And I know that to be true. But at the same time, I'm like, were you doing the best you could? I bet you if I even bring up this example to my dad, I bet you he doesn't even remember. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that's the hard thing because at least for my parents and my dad in particular, it's like pretty much he would black out. Like, you know, it was so it was like a triggered response for him that he would not really remember what happened. So, yeah, I totally believe you that like he probably doesn't even remember because it was not coming out of his conscious brain.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yes. Yes. I remember over the years I've asked my dad, how many times did you try to escape Vietnam by boat before you could get to the refugee camp? And I have notes over the years. They're all different numbers. So it's just kind of like, what is truth? But okay. So now we've got this like heavy context of
sorry, everybody. We're very, I mean, not sorry. Not really sorry. We shouldn't apologize.
No, I'm not going to apologize for what they did. No. I can watch Blossom whenever I want. Please let them do a reboot. But okay, so we've been talking about disciplining, and this is the context in which we bring us as mothers. And here's my question to you. Do you think about all this and go like, oh my God, I don't want to mess up my kid. Oh my God, I don't want to have to pay for their therapy. Oh my God. And then do you, because kids are going to misbehave. Kids are not going to do what you want when you want. Kids are going to, you may have clarified many times to not do something and the impact on their safety. And they're still going to do the thing. Like you're trying to be all whole brain, child, mother, whatever. And then what do you do? Do you ever feel like, I don't want to mess them up. So I'm just going to like be more observing, allow their behavior. Or like inside, do you want to just spank them and be like, get in fucking line? You know what I mean? Like my kid's 3.5 now and he's starting to become slightly manipulative, kind of lying about stuff to get what he wants. Before he didn't really do that, but his brain is changing and his ideas are changing. So I'm curious, is there a part of you that is an enforcer or you're like, no, I'm just going to hold space and allow their feelings. And once it settles down and I'm going to accept that I'm going to be 2 hours late to this thing, or maybe we're not going to go because I'm going to be here for all of it. Or you like, no, we're fucking late. Come on. You know, like what's your stance on disciplining? And then eventually I need tactical how to's because I'm still trying to figure it out.
I have a really funny story to illustrate where we're trying to be now after 3.5 years of being
how it
parents.
Started, how it's going.
I'm going to go work backwards, right? So recently, because we're going to Miami for a month, I wanted to get the girls like more comfortable in the water, blah, blah, blah. Raya hates swimming. She like won't go in the water. So I heard that there is a swim whisperer. Literally, this lady is called the swim whisperer. And she teaches swim lessons out of her private home. And
on Mercer Island?
No, not Mercer Island, Medina, which is even fancier than
yes,
Mercer Island.
Yes, yes. I think
you've heard of this lady? Yeah, she's famous.
Yep.
FYI, Medina, not Medina. Medina is where Bill Gates and Jeff
Bezos. But I think he's like moving to Florida or something.
Yeah, they all start out on Mercer Island, then they get extra rich, then they move to Medina.
Okay, so. Yes. All right. So swimming whisper lady lives here and.
So I was like really curious. Dude, she charges up the wazoo. It basically comes out to $75 for half an hour, but you're not even in private lessons, right? But I was like, look, if this lady is magic, I'll pay for magic. Okay. Because we've tried everything. We've tried the knife. Oh, just fold your thumbs. Whatever. Anyway, we've tried everything. Dude, you know what Nerev labels her address as on Google Maps? Swim Nazi. But he means it affectionately because she gets results. And I'll tell you how. This story is going somewhere. She's like in her 70s. She's no nonsense. You know that older generation of old white American white ladies? Very nice, but like my way or the highway. She has a set of stuff you have to do. For example, Raya didn't want to go into the water. She doesn't like getting her face immersed in the water like many children. And previously, other teachers were like, oh, just go slow. Don't make her feel bad. She'll get there. You know what Susie says? Susie like, dunk her. Just put her in the water. I was like, but she's protesting. Lady was like, do it. I was like, okay, okay. So I like dunk my daughter in the water. Raya is like screaming. And then Susie's, good job, Raya. You did so well. Good job. And then she's like, must do three times. She's like, do it again. I was like, ah. And I think this example is very illustrative of where Nerev and I are sort of like getting to in our parenting style. I've tried Lucy Goose, you know, the whole pseudo positive parenting thing. And then I get really upset with my kids sometimes too. Now I think we're in the authoritative, we're going to set the rules. You do what we do, but we're going to encourage you, but we're going to force you to get out of your comfort zone because we're setting the rules.
By delegating it to this lady.
No, dude, she's really effective. This is, we're on day like 3 yesterday where I was like, I like swimming. When are we going to go back? Can we go back? She's magic, guys. I'm serious.
This is interesting because I took Isaiah, or Jake took Isaiah to the same person. We had very different results. Yeah, she kind of pushed Isaiah's head underwater. And he came up and he was like, I'm not going back in there. And we didn't make him. So yes, interesting. We went to, I'm pretty sure, the same person and
really funny.
Had a different outcome. But I think.
No, wait, it's a different outcome because you listened to your child and then you didn't dunk him again.
Well, yeah. I mean, she just wanted him to like get back in the water. Jake was there and I wasn't there. So I didn't observe this, but he just led Isaiah. He was like, okay, you don't need to go back. But yes, we can talk more about the feelings and the nuances around that. Don't want to interrupt, but I think it's funny that we went to the same teacher and we also heard that she's like basically magic, but it was not magic for us.
Well, it's not magic for everybody. And other methods work for other kids. You know, I think with the preambles that we literally have tried so many different swim instructors and methods with Raya, nothing worked. So I only use this example to be like, we haven't tried this specific method. And I feel like this lady is an interesting combination of she'll encourage you, but she's like, you have to do it.
Yeah.
Right? Whereas before, all our instructor was like, oh, you don't want to feel like, okay, that's fine. We're not going to push. And I feel like Raya had made zero progress. We've spent so much money on taking her to, you know, lessons. And also that's her personality. Like knowing her personality is that if you let her decide, she'll just never do it. But that was to illustrate that Nerev and I came back. We're like, you know, it's interesting because our parents are very authoritarian, right? I think all of our parents, as we've described, seem very authoritarian and we don't really want to be like that. But then I think sometimes when you grow up with very authoritarian parents, you kind of drink the Kool-Aid of gravitating exactly the other way. I think a lot of people that I know, moms that I talk to who grew up with authoritarian parents are want to test out this positive parenting thing. But I think positive parenting is just a very umbrella term, I think, for a lot of different approaches. And I think that some positive parenting should really just be called permissive parenting. It's not actually truly parenting.
Can you give me an example?
I don't understand. I think permissive parenting would just be like, okay, you just always ask the kid, do you want to do this? Do you want this? Do you want to do this? And then the kid always says no. And then you just let that, you're like, okay.
But what if you have to go to school?
Yeah. Okay, well, that's maybe not the best thing. But, you know, you just kind of let the thing, you're okay with being late to school and like you just kind of let them. Yeah.
Can I give another example?
Yes.
I was at like a children's museum with my children the other day and there were kids literally hitting each other and their parents were right there or spraying other people with the waterworks stuff. And their parents were right there not saying anything to them or throwing sand towards
not
other
okay.
kids.
Yeah.
And I was kind of like, hey, could you stop doing that? Please do not throw sand at other people. Please do not spray other people. Their moms were right there. And she heard me say this. And she also did not push back on me. So I'm just like, I guess you're okay with all of this. You're okay with your children spraying water or throwing sand at other kids or hitting them. But you're also okay with me setting boundaries for them.
I thought she would have bitched like, you out.
Oh, yeah. I thought so. I mean, but it was getting to the point where I was like, I don't care. I'm ready for this to end in a confrontation because your kid is not being safe.
I think it's like the kind of parent who will make excuses for a kid like, oh, kids are kids. You know, they'll just whatever, as opposed to teaching kids that there are other people who have different feelings and they need to respect other people kind of thing. So I think a lot of stuff like that gets lumped under positive parenting, but I don't really think that that should be counted as positive parenting.
Yeah, I think, Kay, to what you were saying about like the reactionary response to people who grew up with authority, I don't even know if I would call my parents authoritarian. I would just call them like impulsive, and they really broke my trust all the time. They were both authoritarian, but they also were not like trustworthy, I would say, because so much of their response was like unpredictable, out of proportion with what happened. But I think that one result of that is a little bit like of my internal calibration of what is like an okay response to this situation where it's not going to break my relationship with my child, but also put enough pressure on him or her to push them in the right direction. That calibration for me is kind of broken. So I do feel like I do have a little bit of this impulse to be like either too loose or too strict. Right. And I can kind of swing between these two. And especially if I am stressed or tired or distracted, that's when I start becoming like, okay, you can do whatever. Like I am feeling too stressed out. You need to stop right now.
So like you raise your voice and you get really firm.
Yeah. Or I will like slam my hand down on the table and be like, you need to listen up
shit.
Right now.
And then when that happens, they know.
Yes. But that's not really what I want to do. And I feel like the glimmer, you know, yes, I've read the disciplining book, like, yes, first you want to make your kids feel safe and heard and understood. And I think all of that is important and good and something I try to incorporate. But I think to what you were saying, Kate, what I don't see a lot of guidance in the parenting literature is that kind of how do you set high enough expectations for your kids' behavior and urge them in that direction appropriately, right? And I feel that's something I haven't read that much of. Basically, like the first time I feel like I was kind of clued into it is when Isaiah was like one. I was watching a friend who's older and she has older kids and we were intersecting with them on a vacation. Basically, she herself is very high achieving. Like she went to MIT. I don't think she listened to our podcast. She's in medicine and she's just achieved a lot in many areas of her life. And she was teaching her younger daughter, like they were doing piano practice together. And her daughter was not getting it right. And she was like, we have to do it again. And her daughter didn't want to do it, but she was like very firm and insistent. She's like, no, we're going to do it again. We're going to do it five more times or until you can do it correctly. It wasn't permissive, but it also wasn't scary and it wasn't breaking of their relationship. And I feel like that's the first time when I was kind of like, oh, wow, there's this like other way. I feel like that was like the first glimmer of somebody modeling for me, like what that could look like. And so that's kind of where I am trying to head or like trying to do more consistently, which is like when Isaiah is doing some homework now from school or not a lot. But, you know, if he's like just like, I'm starting to draw random things on my paper to say, no, Isaiah, you need to come back and let's do this again to hold the standards like where I think they should be. Try to find a way to communicate that and urge him in that direction without being like, scary mommy. So yes, I agree with you, like that authoritative parenting, but I feel like there's not a lot of examples in the media or even in parenting books like of our generation. What does authoritative parenting look like? And I also think it differs by the kind of child you have,
yes,
and their personality.
I was just going to say, yeah.
Right? Yeah. Because I feel like that looks very different between my two kids because they have very different personalities. And Ruth, at this age especially, she will push a lot harder than my son will. So I kind of need to take a different tack with her. But I think that's the goal I'm trying to head towards, right? Which is, yes, I want them to feel their feelings and feel safe. I want to prioritize my relationship with them. I don't want to get to the point that I feel like I'm at with my parents, which is when I'm with them, I just feel anxious. I do not feel safe. I do not feel supported. The major feeling I get is anxiety. Mm-hmm. So that is the first priority. But beyond that, in the day-to-day, how do I tell them, well, these are my expectations and we're going to work towards that together. And I'm going to try to help you, like urge you there and to do that work. So yeah, that's kind of where I'm trying to head. But there's not, like I said, a lot of good models per se.
You know, Susan, to reply to your earlier point about art, kind of like maybe starting to, you know, try to do a little manipulation or going behind your back. We've been at this for a year. I think boys maybe a little less so than girls, maybe later. But we are actually in the depth of that with Raya. It's a real struggle. She is just straight up hiding stuff. Like, you know, she's obsessed with candy.
And your kiddo's ages are?
She's almost 4. She'll be like 3 months until she's 4. And then the younger one is like 20 months. So Raya's older one, even if we hide stuff or like we keep things out of her reach, she tries to use other caregivers to access the candy if they don't know about it. Or somehow she found, I have these cough drops that have this medication in them that is not appropriate for children. But I've been having a bad cough. Right? So we told her straight up, we're like, this is not candy. This is medicine. You're going to get sick if you eat this. Guess what? We have caught her opening the cough drop because it's individually packaged and licking it and hiding it somewhere. So today I had a real serious conversation with her. I was like, Raya, first of all, she pretended she didn't open it.
Is it like CBD or something? Like what?
No. It's like some sort of thing in cough syrup that you're not supposed to have until you're like 6 or 7. Yeah. Or something. And so I had to have this conversation. Well, so before, I think my reaction used to be like just really upset. But then Nerf and I realized if we get really upset or we try to punish her, it doesn't work. She's just going to hide more. Basically, have you heard the thing? We'd rather our kids do drugs with us in the house as opposed to do drugs outside the house. One time,
they start so young.
Hopefully they never get to that point.
Yes, exactly. But his whole point was like, I'd rather she be eating candy and us knowing it in the house and her hiding it.
And then you get a whole bunch of ants somewhere.
It's just more of the concept hiding is actually the real problem as opposed to she's actually eating the candy. So now our thing is we don't freak out. We're like, so I went to her and I was like, Raya. So I said, this, I'm just showing you exactly how it's done. And I was like, Raya, did you open this cough drop? And she's like, no, I didn't. I was like, because it was on the nightstand last night and I sure didn't open it. Your sister can't open it because she's small. So you opened it. And then she doesn't say anything because she knows she's been caught. But I was like, you know, I told you this is medicine. If you eat this medicine for adults, you may get sick. And if you get sick, you're going to have to go to the hospital. And if you're in the hospital, mama may not be able to be with you at times. Facts, all facts, right? In like a calm, but like serious tone. And she looks at me, she's like, okay. So she knows. Is she going to do it again? Maybe. Might take a few times, right? Because they're young. Their brains are still forming. They may say yes and realize they can't control their impulses. So that's the other thing is that I've learned to not freak out if it happens a few times, even if we told them, because it takes practice. Kind of like you were saying, Susan, like your parents would freak the F out at you because you didn't fold your clothes after a couple of promptings, right? But that's actually very normal. And so this is how, I mean, trust me, I'm not always as calm, but I think that's what we're aiming for now, as opposed to like, big reaction before or no more candy or this is so bad, you know, like giving them the big reaction because it doesn't really do anything. And also then, you know, maybe they feel unsafe or like they'll start hiding behaviors, right. Which is worse.
Yeah, I think that it could prompt them to just hide more. Yeah, other things that I've tried to leverage are my values. So yes, the times when Isaiah has tried to pass off blame to somebody else that he's clearly done, I will just look at him in the eye and say, mommy thinks you should always tell the truth. That's very important to me. It is. I don't want to have a relationship with him where he's lying to me, right? The other kind of shift in mindset is these are more influencing behaviors rather than absolutes. Because I feel like our parents, the things that they did were more about absolute control, right?
Yeah. Like, because they wanted to mold us to be a specific way to suit them.
Right. And they wanted like immediate results, right? Which is like, you do this, I'm going to hit you. And then you'll stop doing it. But I feel like the things that I feel like I'm trying to use more now are none of them are 100% effective, but like I can kind of try to push him in the direction I want him to go. So it's about my values. It's about boundaries. So it's if you do this, if you do it again, this is what's going to happen. And also giving him clear alternatives instead of whatever hitting or kicking your sister. Like, why don't you go do a picture? Because literally sometimes kids just don't know. They get very fixated on a behavior and they don't know literally what else to do in the moment. So it's giving them a clear alternative. Sometimes I will also just use incentives. Like, this is probably not so good. I try to use this sparingly. I will use this with vegetables because I think vegetables are about exposure. I'm like, if you eat this whole broccoli, then you can have one mini marshmallow after dinner.
I got to get these mini marshmallows and I got to get these chocolate chips that you use because
we're so far gone the pasta chicken nuggets route right now. Like, that's all he eats. Kind of like, I need to bribe.
Yeah. And, you know, again, sparingly, I try to use them sparingly, but I kind of see that is like a tool in my tool set. So I'm trying to think of anything else I've been trying to do.
You know, what's really helped, I think we kind of just illustrated that too, is just narration instead of reaction. With my kids now, I'm trying to, I can't always obviously achieve it because if I'm like hormonal or like tired or whatever, I'll just get upset more. But I will just try to narrate what happened, especially when there's sibling squabbles. I don't know what you do in this case, Jeanette, but I'll be like, I see that, you know, Leela took Raya's blah. And then like, yeah, she took it. And then I'll be like, Leela, should you take Raya's blah, right? Leela kind of at this age isn't really, but I'm practicing,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Or, you know, for example, Leela, when she gets really fussy, I'll ask her like, Leela, you want to stay with mama or do you want to go to Baba? She prefers me. I'm not threatening her. I'm like, I'm going to take you to Baba. She'll be like, mama. And I was like, okay, but if you stay with mama, we can't cry in the middle of the night because mama and Jijit, older sister, Raya, are sleeping. Okay. I feel like there are tricks. I guess back it up. I think we should all be in therapy, which we are, and then work on some of these triggers. I think that's like the minimum that we should do it or you should do if you've undergone a traumatic childhood. But sometimes it takes a long time for therapy to rewire how we think. But in the interim, I think there are some of these tricks that are helpful, like the narration, the giving of choices, like Jeanette said. I think that's a great option because you get to choose the choices and they choose between your choices as opposed to leaving things open. Right. Because kids literally, they don't understand what's good for them at this young age. So you're creating a safe space for them by giving them those choices. And then the other thing I try not to do is, I think with two, I was reading this book. I think I mentioned to you guys, it's something about sibling rivalry prevented or whatever. Anyway, TLDR is you don't say, oh, look, you're so better than your sister. Or like, it's just when they do something good, you praise them for it. But like, don't mention the other person. These sort of things to encourage the behavior that you'd like to see.
Yeah, that's another tool in the arsenal is Shamu. You can Shamu your husband. You can also Shamu your children.
I remember you were saying this.
Remember, we had this whole conversation. Yeah. We talked about it in the previous episode about this. There was a New York Times article about what Shamu taught me about my husband. And it was like the most emailed article in the history of the New York Times. It came out probably 15 years ago, but it's about this animal trainer who works at SeaWorld and she works with the orcas there. And she talks about how basically it's about positive behavior reinforcement, how praising the behavior that you want is more effective than providing negative response to behavior you don't want. She has some other things there, which I also think is interesting, but this is like the major point of her article. And so, yes, that's the other thing I should have mentioned. I'm not an expert, so I'll just put a big caveat out there, but I'm just saying these are the things that I've been using that I feel have been helpful and a little bit of my mindset shifts around here. But yeah, positive reinforcement is good. I think some good things about it is that they get your attention when they're doing something good instead of only when they're doing something not good. I think that that's important, but also you draw the attention to the desired behavior. So it's like when they share something or they make a great drawing or they stayed in bed until they were supposed to get up, just don't let those opportunities pass. Just be like, oh, I noticed that you blah, blah, blah. I will add one other thing that I've been doing, which sounds very trivial and silly, but I feel like has saved me a couple times, which is when I start feeling very frustrated with them, like putting on their shoes and all of that. Like, I'll just sing, I'll just make up a song. Isaiah, Isaiah, put on your shoes, put on your shoes. We'll be late for school, you know? So I'll just start making up a song and just singing because I've just said it to them so many times. I'm tired of saying it to them, but somehow I feel like the song brings some levity back into the situation. And also it grabs their attention. But all of these things, I have to have the fucking energy to do it. Like, I'll just put that asterisk.
Yeah. Singing. That's a good one. I'll try that. Yeah. Goofiness. Like, Nerv is really goofy and he gets them to do stuff by being goofy or horseplay stuff. I don't know. This is maybe a result of my upbringing or maybe the mom role, right? I feel like a lot of moms have a hard time being the goofy horseplaying kind of thing, right? Because we're always like a taskmaster trying to get people out the door. But it does work for my kids, like when Nerev tries it. Back to the shoes and out the door example, I do a couple of things. One is I count down.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. I love the counting.
I have patiently asked many a time. And then I go 5. And then I get really angry at it. 4. And then I get to 1 and I go, I'm leaving right now. I'd like for you to come with me. And then I just start walking out the door. And then he loses his mind. And then he wants me to help him. And then he goes. But it's like, come on, bro. You know how to do this. Okay. So there's the countdown. And then if there's really crazy behavior, like say he did something, I find it sinful if he takes food and if he actually like throws a bowl off the table and like food spills. Rarely happens. Yeah. But if he's like so mad about something, you know, okay, maybe he has some feelings about something, whatever. Like, I won't get into it. But we don't watch TV during the week. But husband loves to use it as a tool on the weekends. So then when we get to like Monday, kiddo's still like addicted to TV and like not cool with the transition, right? Okay, pretend that happened. And then say Art did something like throw some food or maybe kind of tries to punch me or something. I got to draw the line if it was like really not okay. And I say, don't do that. That's not okay. But if you do that one more time, you're going to get a timeout.
I think that's really good. It's that kind of putting a space between like what happened and then repeat. Because sometimes they do it knowing it's wrong. Sometimes they're doing it without thinking about it. Like, I also just tend to agree with the practice of if they did something that they shouldn't do first time, not punishing right then, but to say that now you know that's not okay. If you do it again, this is what's going to happen, right? So you have given them fair warning and they have a choice.
Totally. My timeouts, and we've only done two ever in the history of my parenting with Art. The timeout is I pick him up. We walk into his room. He's like kicking and screaming. I close the gate and I say, do you want to have a timeout by yourself for 5 minutes or do you want me to sit with you? But you need to sit on your bed. And this is like devastating. This is devastating. But nobody was slapped. Nobody was called dumb. And oh my God, you have to sit on your bed. I'm still giving him choice, which is he doesn't have to be alone and cry.
Yeah.
Right. Mm. But now you've removed your benefits of whatever you had. And now we're going to, this is what we must do. And I'm going to turn on timer. That's like devastating to him, but it really works. I haven't used it many times, but that also really works too. Oh, my last one is putting on PJs and brushing the teeth. Always so hard because he wants to keep playing. It's so fun. But we're co-sleeping right now. And so I say, okay, I'm going to set the timer for 5 minutes. If this all doesn't happen in 5 minutes, you're sleeping in your bed tonight. And that's also devastating to him. And I'm like, you got this turtle sanctuary, bro. It's a nice bed. In fact, your father sleeps in it many a night. And that also works too, because then it's a game. And then now there's a constraint. And we all can hear when the timer's going to go off.
I love timers.
It's been really great.
What is it about them? Like, they obey.
I think the other thing about kids is that they don't have a good sense of time. So if you ask them to do something now, it's like, what is the expectation of now? I don't even know how to count right now. I think time, some of it is developmental. Mm-hmm. The whole idea of time, they do not share the same expectations or sense of time. So I think making it very immediate for them and more visual and like more tangible to them is actually helpful. I was going to say something, Susan. I was going to make a confession.
What's your confession? Are you judging me for co-sleeping?
No, nothing like that. I was going to just say, in spite of all of these things, sometimes in the back of my mind, I just want to not exactly do what my parents did, like hit them, but like, I want to let my inner rage out.
Like, you don't know how lucky you have it.
Yeah, the kind of in that vein is just like, how many effing times do I have to ask you to put on your blah, 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 you know? Yes. I will just say that voice and that urge is in the back of my head many a times. And I have this fear that even though I'm doing all these things and overall, I believe that I am inflicting like less trauma on my kids than my parents did, that there's an aspect of that voice that's still like seeping out in my interactions with them. And it's still there, that kind of, oh, I just want to have a violent outburst right now. So I will just make that confession. I wish it wasn't there, but it is. So anyways, to any other mom who might have that voice, it's real. You're not the only one. Maybe I'm the only one.
I don't think you're the only one, but like, how could you expect that to go away in one generation? Like, of course you feel that way.
Well, and the other thing too is, you know, I always go through this with my therapist. I'm like always beating myself up in front of her. And she'll always have to tell me to take a step back and be like, do you think you're a better parent to your kids than your parents were? And it's not so that I can rest on my laurels, but she wants to assuage my guilt, right? Because I'm trying so hard, but I'm still like shitting on myself to her about something that I did. And she was like, you are already good. This is where I am trying less to read parenting stuff on Instagram and social media because I feel like it lacks context. The parenting advice now in these like short little spurts, it lacks the context of the parent having trauma and having to wrestle with a lot of their own issues and their progress. Maybe I'm not like here like this other parent who hasn't had as much trauma, but my progress is like here. But I can't get that from social media, right? I just feel, oh shit, I'm not there. So then I beat up on myself. And then the other thing is, I don't think that advice is customized. Like Jeanette was saying earlier, every child is different. If you have more than one child, each one is going to be really different. There's no calibration for that either. This is what you do, and this is what you don't do. And then, you know, for example, Susan, I think the way that you described your timeouts with art makes so much sense to me. It's such a great way to do a timeout. But for me, for a while, I was so against timeouts because social media was saying, don't do timeouts. It will damage your child's like brain development or blah, blah. You know, like, although there are all these sound bites out there. And I feel like it's so stressful. And we always feel like we're just not doing it. Or I always feel like I'm not doing enough. Even though if I take a step back, I'm like, whoa, I'm providing my children with a childhood already that is so, so different from how we experienced. Again, not to say we should rest on our laurels, but I also think we should take time to celebrate or pat ourselves on the back a little bit for how freaking hard we've had to work at reaching maybe a level that I want to say maybe some other people just seem like they're better parents, right? But who knows? Maybe they haven't had to go through the same kind of shit. Maybe they have and they're just better people, whatever. Maybe that's, nah, who knows?
Everyone's on their journey, but right. We can all cry into our tea and say, I'm a good mom today.
Yes. Please, everybody go cry into your tea. Say, I'm a good mom or dad.
A mom friend I was dating told me about the bed timeout thing.
I think that's a good way to do it because some of the criticism of timeouts is the emphasis on isolation. But I like that you give him the option of sitting with you. So it's not about you are bad, therefore you deserve to be by yourself and banished. And also that, you know, I think timeouts can be good in the sense they're kind of a reset. I'm like kind of out of control right now and I don't know what to do, but just forcing him to slow down and have some a little quiet time. I think that's good.
Yeah, it changes whatever stimuli you had of whatever the scenario occurred. I remember I used to get timeouts, like they'd be like, go to your room. And then I would cry in my room. And then it would be hours because I didn't know when I was allowed to come out. And then it would be like mealtime, hours later, like dinner time. And then someone would yell for me to come eat dinner. But I think they genuinely forgot I was there, you know, like, and I just didn't know I was allowed to leave. It was very confusing. All right. Well, next time you want to yell at your kids, realize who's really yelling? Is that my trauma yelling? Or is it the fact that I really want to make this gym class discipline? It's so much more than that. And I wish you all luck in just continually figuring it out as you change, as your child changes. You know, it's complicated. It's really complicated. But I think, Kate, what's really sticking with me is my kid having a better childhood than mine? You know, am I doing it better? Is it incrementally better today? Maybe not the best today, but maybe if it's slightly better. And if I'm just even thinking about these things, that's one step forward. For my inside thought, I'm going to get morbid. You ready?
More morbid?
Oh, yeah. Morbid. I mean, yeah. Okay. So when you die, do you want to be buried, cremated, or recomposed?
What is recomposed?
It's where
you get composted.
Yeah. They put your body stainless steel thing in this like giant thing of dirt. And then over 10 weeks, your body decomposes and then it turns into 1 cubic foot of soil. And then they shake it all out in case you had a hip replacement or something. They take out like non-organic matter. And then you can like go back into the world. Your family can take your dirt and do stuff with it.
Is this new? I haven't
Seattle
heard of this.
It's very Seattle.
Oh my.
There's not that many. It's just not an option in all parts of the country. I think this is a Seattle innovation.
So Marvin and I are having date night next week. And I think I'm going to take him on a tour of this place. It's in Snowdon.
For date night? What's wrong with you?
Embrace
That's
your difference.
Not dating.
Embrace your uniqueness. Oh, I think it's great.
You can only.
I want to go on a. Yeah.
Oh my God. Wait, do you guys want to go on a tour with me? Oh, wait.
No. I was going to say that I want to go on a date night to our Seattle watershed. That's on my date list.
Okay, wait. So I might get recomposed also going to date night with that. So you're telling me what your date night is. But Jeanette, would you want to be cremated, buried, or recomposed?
I don't have strong feelings about it. I'm leaning towards cremation and just like having my ashes blown about somewhere.
Totally. But where would it be blown?
Could I be like separated? I feel like half of me should be on the Charles River and half of me should be here in Seattle, maybe in the Puget Sound. I don't know why, but for some reason, I don't like the idea of having one thing where I'm supposed to be, like having a grave, even with the composting thing, like having a tree or something. Because what if the tree dies and, you know, my kids or whoever else cares about that I died, you know, will just feel so bad. I feel like it's stressful for them. So I kind of just want to be in the ether, but in some area so that somebody could come and talk to me or feel that I'm like around, but it's not like one place, you know?
Whoa, deep.
Is that deep?
Like I did. Well, yeah. You just told me two important places to you, right? You just told me that you want to be in the ether. I'm like, whoa, this is like deep shit right now. Kate, how about you?
You know, probably cremation. All Chinese people have to get cremated because there's no land in China. So I'm just used to the concept of cremation. I also don't want people digging up my body in, I don't know, 1,000 years and displaying it in a museum. No, thank you.
Yeah. I don't want there to be like a lot of physical stuff like left, I think.
Yeah. I might, though, instead of, you know, scattering my ashes somewhere, I might have them housed somewhere. But, you know, TBD,
like,
I don't know.
Do you want a Tiffany urn and it's in the house?
No. Sooner than that. Come on. No, I do not need a Tiffany urn. This is very traditional of me, where my descendants could maybe pay respect to me. Because every time I go to China, I go to all my grandparents' grave, and I do the offering them the fruits and the incense. And I think there's something really beautiful about that, just remembering my grandparents. I mean, I'm hoping that my grandchildren, maybe if I have any, might be doing the same. I don't need like the fruit or anything, but it would be nice for them to kind of hold, you know, have a place to go to. But I don't know where yet.
I was like, well, would you want it to be at where your grandparents' thing is? So they have this kind of like Chinese homecoming, or by then they'll be like so mixed race that they'd be like.
Yeah, that's a good question. TBD. I don't know.
So detached.
That's a good question.
Yeah, that's why I don't like the whole physical markers, because I'm just like, well, where does it end? How about your great grandchildren? Or, you know, what if they lose the urn? You know, I kind of want to just be accepting that I was like here and then I'm not here. My kids will remember me, but at a certain point, my memory will fade, or it'll live on, but it'll just be kind of an echo in my descendants' lives, right? But I don't need to be this thing that they need to lug around. Yeah, that's kind of how I feel about it.
Well, I mean, it creates burden on the living.
Yeah.
Like I know with cleaning graves or grave maintenance, there's always some drama in the family of who's paying for it. You know? So then there's kind of that. Can I get like a park bench or a statue or something? You know, like Jeanette, you'd be like all in the ether, but I kind of want this place. And it doesn't have to be a grave per se. I mean, my mom's tombstone is in the Bay Area. And like, I don't know, you can put my name there too, I guess, you know, like, sure, maybe it's there, but there's something around like where it's a place of reflection outside the grave. I don't know. There's something there where that's why I'd be like, yeah, recompose me, because I don't want to like, oh my God, funerals are expensive in terms of like, you buy this coffin thingy and then it's like in the ground and then you buy the land for that. That shit's like 30 to 50 grand, you know, like more money for what? My thing's around like the money and the waste around it. But I still want, sure, remember me if you want. I'm good with park bench. So anyways, I'm going on the recompose tour.
Okay, next episode, you can tell us how it was.
Date night. And that's it for Model Minority Moms.
We hope you found something helpful, reassuring, or interesting in this episode of Model Minority Moms. If you enjoyed the episode, please help us spread the word by texting a friend about our show or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. If you want to connect with us, please visit our website at modelminoritymoms.com or follow us on Instagram, where we love receiving messages from our listeners.